So yeah, I'm a fifth year graduate student in the Caltech Department of Astronomy. I've been working with Mark Kamenkowski, and so I've recently moved over to Johns Hopkins with him. And so with Mark, I've been typically working on particle dark matter phenomenology. Yeah, I've done a little bit of indirect and direct detection studies, but today I'm going to be telling you about collider production of dark matter, and in particular, collider production of light gravitino dark matter. So this is work that I did with both Mark and also Jonathan Feng, who's at UCI. And I guess you can find it at the archive address. There. And then so I'll spend most of the talk telling you about these light gravitinos. So the title of this paper is Light Gravitinos at Colliders and Implications for Cosmology. So I'll tell you a little bit about that. And then I'll also, if I have time at the end, tell you a little bit about some follow-up work that was sort of a spin-off of this paper. And so this is work concerning charged particle decay at finite temperature. And so this is some work that I did with also Mark, and then also Kirill Melnikov, who's also at Hopkins, and Andrei Charnitsky. And so that can be found here. Okay, so let's start with the first paper, Light Gravitinos at Colliders and Implications for Cosmology. And so first of all, what is light gravitino? What is a light gravitino, and why might it be a good dark matter candidate? Now before we answer that, maybe I should tell you a little bit about supersymmetric dark matter in general. And so yeah, as you probably know, your typical supersymmetric dark matter candidate is the neutralino. Yeah. And so supersymmetry is some symmetry, purported symmetry in nature between bosons and fermions. For every boson in the standard model, you got a fermion, right? Superpartner and vice versa. And so neutralinos are in some sense the fermionic superpartners of the electroweak gauge bosons in the standard model. So et cetera, right? And so the reason why particle cosmologists, astrophysicists are interested in neutralinos is because they're good dark matter candidates. They're WIMPs, weakly interacting massive particles, neutral, and they give you roughly the right relic abundance through this WIMP miracle. Right? So they're the lightest supersymmetric particle, stable, good dark matter candidates. However, today we're not going to be talking about neutralino dark matter. We're going to be talking about gravitino dark matter. And so the gravitino arises in theories of supergravity, and it's in some sense the supersymmetric partner, the fermionic supersymmetric partner of the graviton, which mediates the force of gravity. And so in particular, we're going to be focusing on theories of supergravity where the gravitino is the LSP, and therefore some other supersymmetric particle is the NLSP, or the next lightest supersymmetric particle. And in particular, we're going to be talking about theories of supergravity in which supersymmetry breaking is gauge mediated. So these are called GMSB theories. And these theories lead to gravitino masses which are relatively light, in the range from around an EV to an MEV, as we're going to be concerned today. And so this is interesting because, as you know, we're mainly interested in weak scale supersymmetry. So this solves lots of problems in the standard model and also gives us these weakly interacting massive particles. And weak scale supersymmetry gives you new CZ particles, which are at the weak scale and are much, much heavier than these light gravitinos, right? OK, so these are the light gravitinos that we're going to be talking about today. That's where they come from theories of supergravity. And so the first thing to ask is, how do these gravitinos interact with other particles? How do they interact with other standard model particles and other supersymmetric particles? And so the easiest way to think about this is using what's called the Suzy vertex rule, right? So this is sort of a rule of thumb. Given an interaction in the standard model, what's a corresponding interaction that occurs in the supersymmetric version of the theory, right? And so as one example, we can look at the basic interaction of QED. So as you know, QED, the basic interaction vertex is a charged fermion interacting with a photon. And what the Suzy vertex rule says is if I swap two of these legs with the corresponding supersymmetric partner, that gives you a vertex that occurs in the supersymmetric version of quantum electrodynamics. So for example, if I swap this charged fermion with its sfermion partner, keep this guy the same, and I swap this photon with its supersymmetric partner, which is in some sense a neutralino. What the Suzy vertex rule says is that given this interaction in QED, we've got an interaction in supersymmetric QED, which looks like this. It couples a sfermion with a fermion and neutralino. Okay, so we can use the Suzy vertex rule to motivate the form of the gravitino interactions. So heuristically, we know that gravitons interact with matter. So this is some graviton. And they transmit the force of gravity. Let's use the Suzy vertex rule. Again, swap this guy with its partner. Q keep this guy the same, and now swap this graviton with its gravitino partner. So this gives us one form of a gravitino action. And as you can see, the gravitino couples a standard model particle, standard model fermion, with its SUSY partner. Okay, so that's one example of a gravitino in action. Another example, heuristically, we know that gravitons not only couple matter to gravity, they transmit the force of gravity, but they also, in some sense, couple energy to gravity. So we can write a similar gravitational vertex with a photon. Uses SUSY vertex rule. Let's swap this photon with its partner, which again is in some sense the neutralino. Keep that photon the same, and again swap this graviton with its gravitino partner. So this gives us another example of a gravitino reaction. Neutralino coupled to a photon and gravitino. And so these forms of vertices are going to be interesting at colliders. In particular, maybe I should mention, in most theories of gravity-mediated supersymmetry breaking, which give light gravitinos, the NLSPs are neutralinos, as I've written here, but there are also many regions of the parameter space in which the NLSP, the next lightest supersymmetric particle, is a charged style. And so we immediately see that these interactions have important consequences for such theories. In particular, this interaction implies that the style is going to decay to a tau plus gravitino. And this interaction implies, of course, that the neutralino is decaying to a photon plus gravitino. Okay? So these are the forms of the interactions. Maybe I should tell you a little something about the strength of the interaction. Now, as you might expect, you know, this gravitino is in some sense a fundamentally gravitational particle interacting via gravitational strength interactions. And so you might guess that the strength is suppressed by the Planck mass, which would be correct. However, because of the way the gravitino couples, the exact form of the coupling, it turns out that there's sort of an enhancement factor to this interaction strength, which goes something like this. It's inversely proportional to the gravitino mass. So the lighter the gravitino is, the more strongly it interacts, and that's why we're interested in these light gravitinos in particular. You see that this scale, the SUSY scale, is much larger, right? Okay. So that's sort of the basics of gravitino phenomenology.
So if the SUSY break mechanism is gravity mediation,
right?
So all the strength will be really 1/m².
Right, right. So here we're talking about gauge mediation, and so in general, for both gauge mediated and gravity mediated, the mass of the gravitino looks something like this. It's some energy scale squared, some SUSY breaking energy scale squared over the Planck mass, right? And so for these GMSB theories, these gauge-mediated theories, this energy scale is much lower. For the gravity-mediated theories, this is much higher. And so for the gravity-mediated theories, these gravitinos can be as massive or more massive than the other SUSY particles.
And then you don't see them at colliders?
So there's a possibility to see them at colliders, but maybe I'll mention later, the decay times involved are much longer. So months or days or months or years even, depending on what the mass splitting is. Okay. So these are the basic forms of the gravitino interactions. And later I'll talk about, I mentioned what implications these might have for colliders. But let's first turn to cosmology and see what effects light gravitino dark matter is going to have on cosmology. Okay, so the first question to ask is, how is light gravitino dark matter produced in the early universe? And so we can see, by throwing together some of these interactions, how this happens. So the basic idea is, let's for example, we'll throw together this interaction and maybe this interaction. And so as you can see, if I connect these together, what that'll give me is some 2-to-2 interaction, which looks something like this. Okay? And so the basic idea is, in the early universe, we've got inflation, which occurs, then reheating follows. Reheating brings all of these other particles in the MSSM, in the minimal supersymmetric standard model, into thermal equilibrium. And so you've got this bath, thermal bath of SUSY and standard model particles. Okay? Now, as you can see by these diagrams, these guys can then scatter via 2-to-2 interactions, 2-to-2 scattering interactions, to produce a single gravitino and some other standard model particle. And so these guys are in the thermal bath. You get 2-to-2 scatterings. And so this is how gravitinos are thermally produced from the thermal bath. And so some people here have done this. calculation to see what is the total thermal production rate. So this has been done in the literature. Also, Yosef has also worked on this. And so what people look for is they take all of these two-to-two interactions, take all the possible final and initial and final states, and they calculate the total production rate as a function of temperature. So this is the production rate per volume as a function of the temperature of the thermal bath. And what this roughly looks like is some numerical factor on front. It goes roughly as this interaction strength squared, because you know you're writing down these diagrams, squaring them up to get the rate. And so there's some factor, which looks roughly like this. And if you work out the units, you can see that the temperature dependence goes roughly T to the 6. Okay, so the hotter the thermal bath is, the more rapidly these things are produced. And most interesting for us, the lighter the gravitino is, you know, the more strongly it interacts. And again, the higher this production rate. Okay, so this is how fast the gravitinos are produced in the early universe. And I might, should probably mention now, for gravitinos this light, all of these processes are happening roughly on the order of time scale of nanoseconds. So very early in the universe. So the next question to ask is, given that this is how fast these gravitinos are produced thermally, do they ever reach thermal equilibrium? And so we can answer this question by simply writing down the Boltzmann equation. So this is the rate of evolution of the number density of these gravitinos. It's got your standard Hubble dilution term from the expansion of the universe. The production rate goes on this side. And there's also some corresponding annihilation rate for the inverses of these processes. You know, these gravitinos can also be destroyed thermally. Okay, we'll plug in these expressions. So this goes as temperature to the 6. As I said, this happens on timescales of nanoseconds. So the universe is still radiation dominated. So this Hubble expansion factor goes something like this. And now what we want to ask is, does this gravitino abundance, this gravitino number density, ever approach an equilibrium density? And so for an equilibrium density, because this gravitino is so light, it's going to reach an equilibrium abundance for a relativistic species, which goes something like T cubed. Okay, so you have some rate equation. All of these things depend on temperature. And so you can say, how hot does it have to be before these guys actually reach equilibrium? And so if you work out the math, what that gives you is that the temperature of the universe must be greater than this in order for these gravitinos to reach equilibrium. Okay. So one thing to note is that this scales with the gravitino mass squared. The lighter the gravitino, the more easily it's produced, the lower temperature you need to reach. But the other interesting thing to note is that this temperature out in front, this temperature scale, is rather low, relatively low, compared to typical temperatures you expect for early universe theories. So for example, if you're talking about things like thermal leptogenesis, et cetera, this is, this temperature scales at which those occur is closer to, maybe 10 to the 7, 10 to the 8 GeV. So this is a very low temperature. And so what this tells you is that these light gravitinos probably almost always reach thermal equilibrium. So you see that if you tune the gravitino mass to be much, much heavier than this, maybe you get hotter and hotter temperatures. But for the mass scales that we're interested in, this temperature out in front is relatively low. So the punchline is that gravitinos which are in this mass range probably always almost reach thermal equilibrium. Okay? Now given that these guys are in equilibrium, they freeze out at some point, and then they therefore form a thermal relic abundance. And because they're relativistic, they're hot relics, right? So you've got some thermal abundance of hot relics, and you know how to calculate the abundance for hot relics. This is similar to how the neutrino abundance is calculated, for example. So the expression for the relic abundance of a hot relic looks something like this. It's directly proportional, linearly proportional to the mass of the hot relic, and it's inversely proportional to the number of degrees, relativistic degrees of freedom at the time when that hot relic froze up. So for the gravitino, as a hot relic, the expression looks something like this, these particular scalings. And if you recall for the neutrino, the expression is exactly the same for the neutrino abundance, except you know those guys freeze out at G star closer to 10, and so this mass here is closer to 10 eV. Okay, so using this expression for the relic abundance, we can immediately place some constraint on the gravitino mass coming from cosmology. And you see that this implies that if the gravitinos are lighter than about 100 eV, they don't overclose the universe, and they're probably an okay dark matter candidate. However, if they're heavier than about 100 eV, they're going to overclose the universe, and you have some constraint coming from overabundance. Okay, so that's one constraint on the gravitino mass coming from cosmology. However, we've got a second set of constraints, which come from,
So again, what is the constraint? So you want the abundance of gravity to be smaller than 10% of the current energy density?
No, no. So the relic abundance of dark matter is known to be about 0.1. Omega H squared for dark matter is 0.1, right? Independently, you can write down the expression for the relic abundance of gravitinos. This is just because they freeze out in the typical hot relic way. And that looks something like this. And so now constraining this to satisfy the dark matter abundance, that gives you know, roughly M gravitino lighter than 100 eV, right?
Sorry.
Yeah.
What's the lifetime of gravitino? Can it decay particles?
So now for this paper, we assume that the gravitino is stable. So you might imagine if there's some R parity violation or something like that, your gravitinos could then decay later. But we don't consider those kinds of theories for this paper. So this is a stable dark matter. Hot relic. Okay, so one constraint coming from the abundance, and the second constraint comes from small scale structure considerations. So small scale constraints, and in particular, they come from measurements of the Lyman alpha forest. So these measurements also give us some constraints on the gravitational mass. And if we combine these two constraints, we sort of get three scenarios, three light gravitino dark matter scenarios in cosmology.
Can
okay?
I ask you, are you also including the abundance coming from the NLSP decays?
So non-thermal decays, no, for this paper, we're just assuming the thermal production. So there is another component coming from decays, which look like this, not 2 to 2, but 1 to 2, for example. Let's assume for the time being that those are some non-dominant contribution to this abundance. That's not always true, but for now, let's assume that. And we'll come back to that point later, actually. Okay, so three scenarios, and these scenarios are categorized by the gravitino mass. The first scenario, you've got really light gravitinos. The second scenario, you've got sort of intermediate mass gravitinos. And finally, in the last scenario, you've got relatively heavy gravitinos. And we can see what these cosmological constraints have to say about these three scenarios. Okay, so let's take a look at the first one. In the first one, you see that the gravitino is so light that it only forms some small fraction of the total dark matter relic abundance. And so it doesn't violate the constraint, so it's OK. But you're only forming some fractional component of the total dark matter. So in this model, you've got some hot component of dark matter that forms maybe 30%. And the rest of the dark matter is some other cold component. Okay, so this is some mixed dark matter model. Okay, and it turns out that if the gravitino is indeed this light, it also satisfies the small scale structure constraints. Now, you might expect the lighter the gravitino, the lighter the dark matter particle, the more structure it wipes out. But because it only forms some fraction of the dark matter, it doesn't wipe out too much structure. So this constraint is still satisfied. OK. So let's go to the third scenario. Here you see that the gravitino will be overabundant by about a factor of 10 or more. And that's bad. You know, this scenario is ruled out by the abundance constraint. However, it turns out that ignoring the abundance constraint, in this case, dark matter is cold. And so it doesn't wipe out too much structure. So ignoring the fact that it's overabundant, you can still satisfy the small-scale structure constraints. Okay? And finally, in this intermediate scenario, you see that for some ranges, you're not overabundant, but as you get heavier and heavier, you do get overabundant, so you may violate the abundance constraint. And it also turns out that in this case, the Gravitino is still, it's a little too light, and so now you're starting to violate these small-scale structure constraints. It's too hot, and you're wiping out too much dark matter, or too much structure. Okay, so these are sort of the three scenarios that are coming from our current cosmological constraints. They're separated by the Gravitino mass. And what we showed in this paper is that these three mass ranges coming from cosmology actually line up very nicely with three scenarios that you might expect to find at colliders. Okay, so let me go on to describe those.
Sorry.
Yeah.
How is the first scenario satisfied with small scale structure?
So the Gravitino is light, but if you assume that it only forms some fraction of the dark matter, it's okay. It's not wiping out too much. Now, in this second scenario, if you assume, sorry,
in the first scenario, its temperature is higher than the average.
Right. You can think about it in terms of the free streaming scale. Also, depends on that temperature. Right. Okay. So, the distinction between this scenario and this scenario is that here we assume that the dark matter is completely Gravitinos. Okay. So, if you make that assumption, then you can't satisfy the constraints. If you relax that assumption and let it be only some fraction, including a cold component, then you can satisfy the constraint. Okay.
Can you remind us on what's the lifetime of LSP? Because now you're actually dumping a huge amount of energy into the observable sector because you have a very light.
So for.
Your LSP has to be at the electric scale.
Right. So because the mass splitting here is so large, the decay time scales are roughly nanoseconds. Okay, so all of this stuff is happening well before BBN. So you're not, for example, dumping energy and destroying nuclei after BBN.
One more quick question.
Yep.
So you're not going to consider non-thermal production of Gravitino?
So our argument later will be, I'll get to that point later. But for setting these scenarios, we're not considering the non-thermal. And there's some argument that you could say, well, that component is probably subdominant compared to the thermal contribution. But. Okay, so let's take a look at what happens at colliders now. Now, as I said before, what's important for colliders is going to be, as we just mentioned, these NLSP decays, which occur on timescales of nanoseconds. And so the picture here is we've got protons smashing together. These guys will hopefully produce supersymmetric particles. You'll typically produce the strongly interacting particles first, working gluonos. These guys will then cascade down to the electroweak Suzy particles, and eventually they'll cascade down to the NLSP. And typically, if we preserve our parity, we're going to get two NLSPs, some pair of NLSPs produced at colliders. Okay, so all of this stuff is happening on collider timescales, your typical collider timescales. They're happening via your usual electroweak and strong gauge interactions, and so this stuff happens very quickly, very promptly. However, these two NLSPs can then decay to two Gravitinos and the standard model partners of the NLSPs. And as we said before, this stuff is happening on gravitational timescales, and therefore it can be much longer. Can occur much after these collider timescales. And because of this delay, this can produce some interesting signals at colliders. Okay, so let's take a look at some of these signals. So here's some detector at the LHC. You've got your protons interacting at the interaction point. And if all we had was Suzy or the standard model, you get prompt interactions and you just see some spew of particles coming directly out of the interaction point, right? However, the point here is going to be that because these decays to Gravitinos happen much later, those decays can happen non-promptly, away from the interaction point, and can actually happen within the detector. Okay? So let's take a closer look at the actual structure of the detector. We've got the beamline and the silicon tracker. And the silicon tracker starts maybe a few millimeters away from the beamline. A little further out, we've got calorimeters and we've got charge tracking capabilities. So a little further out, at maybe a few meters, we've got the ability to detect charge particles and also photons. And finally, further out, we lose the calorimeters. All we've got is the ability to track charge particles in the muon chambers. And these are scales of roughly 10 meters, depending on whether you're at Atlas or CMS. And so in this last region, we can only detect charge particles. OK, and now it turns out that these different regions of the detector separate the gravitino signals into exactly these three scenarios. OK, so let's consider one scenario. Actually, maybe I should write down one more formula. So I said that these decays can happen within the detector, these decays from NLSP to gravitino. And you might ask, what's the expression for the distance at which these NLSP decays to gravitinos occur? So this looks something like this. You get some Lorentz factors because these NLSPs are produced with some non-zero energy, right? So there's some Lorentz factors which dilute this length. This distance is proportional to the square of the gravitino mass and goes something like the inverse fifth power of the NLSP mass. And the overall scale is roughly meters. So from this formula, we see a few things. The lighter the gravitino, the more promptly these decays occur and the closer to the interaction point they occur. The greater the gravitino mass, the further away they occur, the larger this distance. The other interesting thing is that this scale out in front just happens to be on the size scale, the same size scale as the size of the detector. So that's some coincidence just because of these gravitino mass scales and the weak mass scales that we choose and the Planck mass that this happens to be 20 meters. So it's an interesting coincidence. We're meter size beings. We construct meter size detectors. And this decay scale just happens to be meter size. So that makes it very interesting for collider phenomenology. OK, so let's take a look at the first scenario, in which the gravity.
So the thing, I think maybe this is implied over here, but you didn't. So in scenarios 2 and 3 over here, the idea is arc parity is violated, so the gravitino will decay when produced.
No. So in all these scenarios, you don't the gravitino is stable.
But then how do you? I thought you argued that it's pulled out in cosmological grounds.
Right. So if you just take these cosmological constraints by themselves, you might be a little pessimistic and say, well, our canonical pictures of cosmology, which we use to interpret these constraints, rules out these mass ranges, right? But as the point that we make in this paper is what we see at colliders is, that tells us something about the gravitino mass range, and it could presumably land us into one of these scenarios. And so that would directly imply that something about our canonical cosmology is wrong. And so that's exactly why these gravitinos are so interesting. OK. So let's take a look at the first scenario in which the gravitino is very light.
Is there something wrong with instead making doing scenarios 2 and 3 and making the gravitino just not stable, or is it wrong?
So in that case, so you would have some relic abundance of the particle that the gravitino then decayed to, right? And so you could try to make that particle obey the abundance constraints. So I guess you could cook something up. But and then you'd be talking about R parity violation, and then you've got some whole other slew of constraints to consider. So okay, so collider signals for the first scenario. So in this scenario, the gravitino is really light. This decay distance is very small, and you in fact get prompt signals. Okay? So let's, for example, consider the case in which the NLSP is a neutralino. So you've got your protons colliding, you produce Suzy particles which decay, cascade and decay to a pair of neutralinos, and these neutralinos then decay promptly, very promptly, to a photon and a gravitino. And so what this turns out to give you is a signal which looks like diphotons, which we heard a little bit about today, I guess, and also a pair of gravitinos. Okay? So these photons are going to be very hard because they're carrying roughly half the energy, half the energy of the NLSP. And these gravitinos are also going to carry away a large amount of missing energy. So what this looks like is a hard prompt diphoton signature with missing energy. So this is sort of a pretty distinct collider signal. So So you get prompt back photons plus missing energy. And if you do the simulations, collider simulations, which you have to do in order to determine these Lorentz factors, in order to determine the energy distribution which these neutralinos are produced, and therefore the distributions of distances, what you find is that you actually get a lot of events exactly in this mass range. And it's just a coincidence that that mass range happens to cut off the number of diphoton signals that you get when the gravitational mass is roughly around 30 eV. So that's coming from some collider simulations. Okay, so that's one scenario, one example of scenario one. Sorry. And so let's take a look at now scenario two. So in scenario two, the gravitino is a little heavier. This decay distance is a little longer. And these neutralinos can actually travel a little bit into the detector before they decay. So as an example, I told you we're only sensitive to photons in the Kalaruru region. So let's consider neutralino decays in this region. So you have some neutralino coming out of the interaction point. That guy decays to some photon plus a gravitino. Now the neutralino is invisible to the detector. The gravitino is invisible to the detector. And so what you just see from the signal is some hard photon just popping into existence in thin air in the middle of the Kalaruru. And so these things are called delay photons, and they're also pretty unique signatures at colliders. And you do the simulations to see how many of these signals you get, and it turns out that you get a lot when you're exactly in this mass range. Okay? So that's some examples of neutralino NLSP signals. However, I mentioned earlier that in these GMSB models, in some regions of the parameter space, the NLSP is the Stout, and it's charged. Okay, so let's take a look at some Stout signals. Okay, so you could also get prompt Stout signals. Those aren't as interesting. Let's look at some delayed Stout signals. So again, in scenario two, when the gravitino is in this intermediate mass range, these decay distances can get into the detector. And for a charged NLSP, it looks something like this. So you've got the charged Stout coming into the detector. That guy decays to a tau, which then promptly decays to some hadrons, et cetera. And you get a gravitino carrying away missing energy. And so the interesting thing about the signal is this. This Stau is charged, so you can see it in the detector. It's relatively heavy. It's at the weak mass scale. And so this track is pretty straight. It doesn't get bent so much by the magnet. So you've got some straight charge track, which then decays to a light charge particle. So if you reconstruct the Stau, the curvature of this track is going to be a little higher than this because this Stau is lighter. And this guy carries away missing energy. So you see some kink charge tract with different radiuses of curvature. And so this is also a pretty unique signal. So you, again, get a lot of these in this second scenario, in this second gravitino mass range. OK, finally, let's consider the third gravitino mass range, where you got relatively heavy gravitinos. This decay distance is then a little longer. And it can, in fact, be larger than the detector. So in that case, all you see is the charge track of the Stau. This charge track extends all the way through the detector, and you don't see this decay. OK?
Can I ask, how light does a particle have to be for the LHC to detect the curvature of its charge particle has to be for the LHC to detect the curvature of its track?
So this is a, it's a hard question to answer, right? And I said this, the tau is decay, right? So there's some additional difficulty with reconstructing it from the decays. But so with the Staus, I think you should even be able to see the small curvature for a weak scale Stau. It's going to be a relatively straight track, but you should be able to measure that curvature. Right? So 100 GeV or so. I don't know the exact numbers.
So can I ask about
yeah.
this change in Tau? So isn't that a generic signal for any
So which
is it a distinct gravitino signature or any neutralino dark matter
lighter than so for the neutralino dark matter, you won't okay. So you're asking if this delayed photon signature is generic for neutralino dark matter?
I was asking for the kink charge.
Well, for the kink charge, you only see those for the Stau NLSP, right? Because you decay first to the NLSP. That guy's charged, it's a Stau, and then that thing decays. I don't know if that answered your question. you're not going to see, the bottom line is you're not going to see these sorts of kinks in the detector for just regular supersymmetry. And that's because you only get into the detector for much weaker or for much longer decay timescales, which only occur if you've got gravity involved, right? So we could qualify some statements. I mean, you could say, hey, you do get prompt photons for other theories. You might imagine that you could get these sort of metastable. Oh, I didn't write this down. So this last category, these signals are called metastable charged. You might also argue that if we see these metastable charge tracks, we don't necessarily know that there's a gravitino at all because we don't see this last decay. But then in that case, you've got some metastable charge particle. If that is indeed truly stable, then you've got a whole other slew of problems. You've got a charged stable particle in your universe. That's bad. Right? So you can only definitively say that these are gravitino signals in this second scenario, right? Because then you actually see the form of the decay vertex. But for the first and third scenarios, you have some pretty strong hints that this is coming from something that looks like a gravitino. Yeah. Okay, so this is basically the punchline of the paper, of the first paper. You know, you consider the phenomenology of light gravitinos at colliders and in cosmology. You can see, you can define these three scenarios by the mass ranges. And the punchline, as I said earlier, is what we see at colliders is what we see, right? That's nature, right? And if the colliders tell us that the gravitino has to be in mass ranges 2 or 3, if we see lots of these delayed photons, kink charge track signals, or metastable signals, we know immediately that something is wrong with the canonical cosmology, okay? So I told you in our canonical picture, we've got inflation, reheating, thermal production of gravitinos during radiation domination, et cetera. And so we've got to tweak some ingredients of this cosmology picture in order to get these scenarios to, again, agree. So we could do that in several ways. We could consider non-thermal production of gravitinos. We could consider some other early universe physics, which dilutes the abundance of gravitinos, for example, and makes these abundance constraints come into line. We could try to cook up some mechanism to cool the gravitinos so they're not so hot and they don't violate small-scale structure constraints, et cetera. So you know, these collider signals aren't going to tell us exactly what that new physics is going to be. But if we're in scenarios 2 or 3, it's going to tell us that we definitely need some new early universe physics. And so I think that's a pretty interesting conclusion. OK, so that was the first paper. I guess I still got a little time, so maybe I'll tell you a little bit about the second paper, which was sort of a spin-off of this first one. OK, so this second paper is charged particle decay at finite temperature. And I guess I erased it. So I told you earlier that people have calculated the thermal production rate of gravitinos from these 2-to-2 interactions that occur in the early universe at finite temperature. They calculated this production rate, right? Okay, and again, it's coming from these sort of 2-to-2 interactions, et cetera. And so all this has been done in the literature. And so Mark, when we were first looking at this problem, Mark was like, you're in the Department of Astronomy. This is some pretty heavy particle physics stuff. There's a lot of Feynman diagrams, et cetera, that go into calculating these rates. Why don't you, as a simple exercise, go and recalculate some of the rates, see what comes up? And so I was like, okay. And so I considered not that rate, which I just erased, not that process, which I just erased, but I considered a different process, just for simplicity, one which looked like this. So this is a photon interacting with the Stau, decaying to its town gravitino. So this also gives you thermal production of gravitinos. So I wrote down this diagram, calculated the rate for this guy as a function of temperature at some finite temperature. And it turns out that you get infinity. So I went, did the Feynman diagram, got the rate, got infinity, went to Mark and said, hey, it's infinity. And he's like, no, it's not infinity. It can't be infinity, right? And so I was like, well, I don't know. So he's like, why don't you go back and do it again? Did it again, it's got infinity, et cetera. And so finally, after about a month or so, he was like, OK, maybe it's infinity. And he, we sat down for a few hours, took a look at it, and he didn't know why it was infinity. We went, Jonathan Feng, who we were writing this paper with, we told him about this problem. He didn't know why it diverged either. We talked to Mark Weiss. He didn't know either. Mark went on a little talking tour. He talked to Mike Peskin, et cetera. All these other people didn't know how to do it. So it was a pretty interesting problem, but we didn't know how to solve it. Finally, you know, Mark moved over to Hopkins, as I was telling you at the beginning. And so at Hopkins, it's Kirill Melnikov, and he saw this problem, and he's like, yeah, that's easy, I know how to solve that. So we both moved over to Hopkins, talked to Kirill, and we wrote this second paper, which shows how this problem is solved. Okay, so let me go a little more into detail. So I told you that there's some divergence, which gives you an infinite rate, and in particular, there's a power-like divergence, okay? And it comes from considering this process when this photon is very soft, when it's not very energetic. And so it's some power-like infrared divergence. And so this is interesting because you know that there are some infrared divergences in, you know, for QED, for example, but these are only logarithmic divergences. So what I'm saying is that we can write down this rate as a function of temperature and as a function of some integral over the photon energy. You know, you've got some thermal distribution of photons, integrate over this distribution. And for the soft photon energies, that gives you the divergence. So what I'm saying is that this gives you something which looks like this when you integrate over photon energies. And this is then a power-like divergence, which is more severe than the logarithmic divergences that you usually get at zero temperature. Okay. However, we can use the mechanism by which these divergences cancel out at zero temperature to sort of motivate how they cancel out at finite temperature. So how do they cancel out at zero temperature? Well, as you know, in QED, you can get logarithmic infrared divergences from virtual diagrams. So from considering diagrams like this, the first radii of correction, in the limit that this photon gets very soft, you get a divergence. And so how are these guys cancel out? Well, you have to consider not only these sorts of diagrams, but you also have to consider Bremsstrahlung of soft photons. Particularly, you have to consider diagrams which look like that, or where you get Bremsstrahlung from the final state. Okay? And so it turns out that if you do all this at zero temperature, the infrared divergence that you get from this virtual diagram cancels exactly the infrared divergence that you get from the phase space integrals in this diagram. Okay? So a very similar thing is happening at finite temperature. And a very similar thing will help you cancel out these power-like divergences. Okay? So what happens at finite temperature is that you've got some finite temperature analogs of these virtual corrections. So for example, you could have some correction to the vertex, which looks like that. And what happens at finite temperature is that this photon propagator, this virtual photon propagator, picks up a temperature-dependent piece. And it turns out that temperature-dependent piece is exactly what cancels out the temperature-dependent piece in the thermal distribution of photons coming from this Bose-Einstein distribution. Okay. So let me just draw the relevant diagrams. So you consider this vertex correction. You consider photon emission from both this charged particle and this charged particle when the photon's very soft. You can consider photon absorption. Now, this is sort of a neat twist at finite temperature. At zero temperature, you don't have photons in the thermal bath. But at finite temperature, you do, and these guys can be absorbed by the charged particles. So you can get processes in which very soft photons are absorbed from the thermal bath. And finally, at finite temperature, you also have to assume, you also have to consider the virtual corrections that are coming from the self-energy of these charged particles. So you've got some diagrams, which look like that. Diagrams, which look like that. And those also enter in the calculation at finite temperature. So that's also another twist at finite temperature. At zero temperature, these self-energy diagrams sort of, you don't have to consider them. Those can be amputated and cancel out. Right. So the simplest version of the problem which these divergences occur is, say, you could say, hey, we've got some thermal bath of particles on this side, but let's ignore the fact that these guys are thermal. Let's just assume that maybe the temperature is very low. These guys aren't thermal. And same thing is true for these guys. And so this problem still occurs when the only particle that's thermal is the photon, and it's simply coming from the fact that you've got this Bose-Einstein distribution for the photons. You're integrating over that Bose-Einstein distribution that gives you this power-like divergence. Okay, so we wrote this sort of paper as a, you know, pedagogical exercise, like, you know, hey, all this finite temperature theory stuff you know, it's known, it's been kind of forgotten by even, you know, all these really smart guys. And so if you're a particle physicist who cares about charged particle phenomenology at finite temperature.
So can I ask, is your example, did you give a thermal mass to the external state photon as well, to the incoming one, or would that cure the divergence?
So, I mean, you can think about this in a couple of different ways. You could say, hey, if you give the photon a thermal mass, that will cut off this divergence, right? But in some sense, that's equivalent to giving this propagator, you know, a finite temperature piece, right? So the physics turns out to be the same, or the math turns out to be the same. So basically, all these photons are coming from the thermal bath, and if you add the temperature-dependent piece correctly to the virtual part, that stuff cancels out with the temperature-dependent piece from the thermal bath. Okay, so all this stuff is pretty well known. You know, we wrote this paper just as a pedagogical exercise. If you care about charged particles in the early universe at finite temperature, which a lot of people do, you know, you've got charged particles floating around at coannihilation, for example. Maybe you could have some finite temperature dependent corrections to coannihilation rates. Or, you know, some people care about charged long-lived staus. Maybe this sort of finite temperature effect can change the lifetime of that stau, have some important implications, et cetera, et cetera. But it turns out in the end, as you might expect, the temperature-dependent corrections are actually very small. So if you write the total rate as a function of temperature, it turns out to be basically the zero temperature rate plus some very small correction. That's also at higher order than alpha. Okay, so you might say, well, this stuff isn't very interesting. These corrections are tiny. They're very small. It doesn't really make a difference. You don't have to consider the finite temperature effects.
Which mass state is
entering? So you could say this is, for example, the mass of the decaying particle, so the mass of the stau in this case. So if you're at very low temperatures, this ratio is already suppressing these effects. And because you're considering additional photons, you've got an additional factor of the fine structure constant. So these guys, probably very small corrections to the rates. However, one interesting thing that came up while we were doing this calculation. So I told you that Kirill told us, you know, he said, you know, I know how to solve that. I solved that problem. Let me dig it out of my desk. And what Kirill actually solved the problem for was not for this stau decay, this two-body decay, but he solved it for muon decay. So muons are also charged particles. They have some three-body decay. There's also a charged particle in the final state. And so the problem is very similar, except it's just a three-body decay with some neutrinos. Okay, so he solved the problem for the muon case, muon decay case, and again, you've got lots of different diagrams that you have to consider, etc. But one interesting quirk that came up in the muon decay case was the form of this decay temperature, this temperature-dependent decay. And so again, you get something which looks like this. You get this very small piece. But it turns out at higher order in the temperature, you also get some mass logarithms. Okay, some terms which are suppressed by this very high temperature, suppressed by this high power and temperature, but are still enhanced by things which look like mass logarithms. So in particular, the logarithm of the mass ratio between the electron and the muon. So what this tells you is that in the limit that the electron is also massless, you get some new divergence, some new logarithmic divergence, which doesn't appear to cancel out. Now this is interesting because these sorts of mass logarithms are known to cancel out at zero temperature. This is some theorem called the Kinoshita-Lee-Nauenberg theorem. And so that theorem is proven at zero temperature. However, just by doing these sort of toy calculations, at finite temperature, we're finding terms that don't appear to be canceled out. And so this is some still unresolved problem. You know, these mass logarithms, you know, this is some modification of the fundamental finite temperature, zero temperature theory at finite temperature. You get new divergences at finite temperature. And so whether these guys remain or whether they're canceled out by some other effect is yet unknown. And so we point this out also in the paper. Yeah, so that's charged particle decay at finite temperature. And I think that's probably about it. Thanks. Sorry?
Would you have the equivalent of the local divergence?
So maybe I should be a little more specific. For this paper, you know, I've been drawing these diagrams for this Gravitino problem, which is where we originally discovered the problem. However, for the paper, to make things more simple, we didn't use the actual Gravitino vertex. We used some toy vertex. You have to consider less diagrams, and it's easier to see how the problem is fixed. So we haven't gone back to do it yet for the Gravitino problem. We don't know if these sort of mass logarithms are still around, but it's possible. So, I mean, these mass logarithms are interesting because they shouldn't be there, basically. There's no reason, if you're considering temperature scales far away from the electron mass, that the electron mass should be a physically important quantity in this sort of decay rate. And so it's kind of puzzling why that guy still hangs around.
And that only happens in three body decays?
Well, that's the only place that we found it so far. So,
is there a particular reason why three body decays are different?
So, well, I mean, it's if you sit down and write, it's very complicated to see exactly where this is arising from. So it's probably not coming from these self-energy bits. It's coming from some, you know, there's some contributions from all these different parts, and those guys don't exactly cancel out to give you the cancellation here.
But it's a one loop thing.
Yeah. So some combination of all these guys is giving you that leftover. Whereas in the toy model we considered, these sort of logarithms canceled out, and that's because the contributions from all the different bits exactly cancel out. So there's some numerical factor that doesn't, you know, you get x plus y plus z, and that equals zero in the toy case, but it doesn't equal zero in this muon case, and so that gives you this leftover term.
The initial external legs, that's also in the zero temperature?
So these external photons are all at finite temperature in this.
No, but like
here?
Yeah.
So, I mean, at zero temperature, you do get infrared divergences from soft external photons, from Bremsstrahlung of a soft photon, but that's just the usual cancellation, Bloch-Nortzig cancellation. So you can cancel out the logarithmic infrared divergences. And what we're just saying is that the mechanism is very similar at finite temperature. You still have, you know, emission and absorption of photons, and when they're very soft, that helps you cancel out the power-like part of the divergence. I don't know if that.
So can you combine the collider constraints with the cosmological constraints and basically rule out thermal production of Gravitinos?
Well, so I mean, if you're pessimistic, you say, well, we're only going to see maybe these sorts of signals at colliders, these diphoton signals. And if you do see those signals, then even then you've only identified some small fraction, some component of the dark matter. So that's pessimistic. I think more interesting is the other way around. We see these signals, which are more unique than diphotons. I mean, we already heard that diphotons say they can come from Higgs, et cetera. You see these more unique signals, some of which tell you that it's definitely something that looks like the Gravitino, and then that tells you you have to modify your cosmology. I think that's more interesting.
But in the pessimistic scenario where I just get a constraint from colliders, is that?
Yeah, so that those constraints are already taken into account when we find this mass range. So we do some scan over the parameter space. We say how many events do we get, and some region of that parameter space is already ruled out because we get too many events which haven't been seen yet at Tevatron, for example.
And that's a bound on the mass of the Gravitino.
So that's a bound on both the mass of the Gravitino and also on the NLSP. Your NLSP can't be too light, otherwise you would have already produced them at Tevatron, for example.
And yeah, just had a question. So you see that we should see this in collider. So
So as far as I know, I mean, people are starting to look at these sort of, you know, metastable charge tracks, especially because those are a little more generic. All of the papers so far only place lower limits on the NLSP mass, for example. So it's not getting that interesting yet. And certainly, I don't think I've seen a paper where they consider diphotons with, you know, lots of hard missing energy. But I might be wrong. But certainly, there hasn't been a paper that has come out saying, well, this is what the LHC is telling us about light gravitinos. Yeah.